From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Thad Hall. Today on the program, we're considering the future of the Republican Party. Just 4 years ago, Republicans seemed on the ropes, with Democrats having control of the U.S. House, the Senate, and the presidency. But 2 years later, we saw a Republican surge. They took back control of the House, won key high-profile races for governor, and almost regained control of the U.S. Senate. With the Citizens United decision, the money advantage seems to be on the side of the GOP. Even with the surge in support for Republicans in 2010, questions remain about the future of the party. America's Latino population is growing rapidly, and support for many social issues at the core of the GOP strategy, like gay marriage, may be shifting toward the Democrats. Some also question the level of public support for the cuts to services that underlie key Republican ideas for reducing the deficit. The future of the GOP, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Thad Hall, an associate professor of political science at the University of Utah, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're considering the future of the Republican Party. Just 4 years ago, Republicans seemed to be on the ropes, with Democrats having control of the U.S. House, the Senate, and the presidency. But 2 years later, we saw a Republican surge. They took back control of the House, won key high-profile races for governor, and almost regained control of the U.S. Senate. With the Citizens United decision, the money advantage seems to be on the side of the GOP. Even with the surge of support for Republicans in 2012, there are still questions about the future of the party. America's Latino population is growing rapidly, and support for many social issues at the core of the GOP strategy, like gay marriage, may be shifting toward the Democrats. Some also question the level of public support for the cuts to services that underlie key Republican ideas for balancing the budget. We've also seen a change in the Republican Party itself. The most prominent study of congressional ideology from VoteView.com at the University of Georgia has found that the current Congress is the most polarized in recent history, and this polarization reflects a dynamic movement of the Republican Party to the right in recent years. We have seen this move right here in Utah, where several members of Congress have been challenged in primary elections for not being conservative enough. Today in the studio, we have Quinn Monson. Professor Monson is an associate professor of political science and is director of the Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy at Brigham Young University. He also helps run the Utah College's exit poll and was out yesterday getting the pulse of Utah's primary voters. Next year, his book on Mormons in American politics will be released. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We also have on Alan Abramowitz. Professor Abramowitz is a professor of political science at Emory University, and he is coming to us from the studios at Emory University in Atlanta. Professor Abramowitz is the author of the books The Disappearing Center, Engaged Citizens, Polarization, and American Democracy, and also the book The Polarized Public, Why Our Government is So Dysfunctional. Welcome to the show, Professor Abramowitz.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Later in the show, we'll have on Mickey Edwards, who is a former member of Congress from Oklahoma and is currently the vice president of the Aspen Institute. And his forthcoming book is called Parties Versus the People, How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into Americans. If you want to join the conversation, please call us at 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Or you can email us at radiowest.org. And you're also welcome to join the conversation on Facebook or Twitter. So let's jump right in and talk about Republicans in Utah. Yesterday, during the primary election, we had a nice challenge for Senator Hatch. And in 2010, you know, Senator Bennett was beaten soundly in the caucuses at the party conventions by Republicans who did not think he was conservative enough. And in 2012, we saw the same strategy, but Senator Hatch survived this sort of challenge. Was the difference here that new people came into the caucus and the convention process, or did Republican activists just get more moderate in 2 years?
Well, I don't think the Republican activists got more terribly more moderate. I think one of the answers is that Senator Hatch got more conservative. And so even though so two things happened. The composition of the state convention changed with more new delegates that were more amenable to Hatch. He recruited some of them. But also Hatch was very good at reaching out to the more conservative element of the Republican Party, and particularly the folks affiliated with the Tea Party. And he persuaded a fair number of them to support him, even though they hadn't supported Senator Bennett. So it kind of came from both directions. It was both Hatch moving to the right and delegates sort of changing their minds about Hatch because he moved to the right. And then there was some new people that showed up.
So, Quinn, what do you think this suggest for moving forward in Utah with Republicans and the given the fact that we have this odd convention caucus process?
Well, it's really an open question because what it took for Hatch to survive was a tremendous amount of spending and effort on his part to reach out to these potential delegates and identify them, get them to the caucus, get them to run as delegates. And so as we look forward to another convention, it's an open question as to whether or not there's another candidate out there statewide with the kind of resources and savvy that the Hatch campaign demonstrated in recruiting those delegates. I don't know if a lot of those people who showed up in 2012 at the neighborhood caucus meetings are going to show up again without the kind of hounding that the Hatch campaign put to them.
Great. Let me bring Professor Abramowitz into the conversation. In your book, The Disappearing Center, you discuss the convergence in the public between people's ideological preferences and their party identification. So for most Americans today, if you're a conservative, you're a Republican, and if you're a liberal, you're a Democrat. Can you discuss a little bit about how this change occurred and how it's affecting politics today?
Well, this has been a shift that we've seen going on over a long period of time. And I think what it goes back to really is initially a very self-conscious effort by a Republican political leader, starting with Richard Nixon with his Southern strategy and continuing with Ronald Reagan and Newt Gingrich and others, to try to appeal to conservatives who were not aligned with the Republican Party. Many of these were Southerners, but they were conservatives in other parts of the country as well. And over time, this strategy has been fairly successful. We've seen a fairly dramatic decline in the percentage of conservatives identifying with the Democratic Party and an increase in the percentage identifying with the Republican Party. I think what was not expected as much was the backlash that we've seen against us. As the Republican Party has moved to the right, we've seen a counter movement of moderate to liberal voters in the Northeast particularly, but in other parts of the country as well, moving in the opposite direction. And so the overall effect of this has been that we now have a much closer alignment between party and ideology within the American electorate.
And you, in your most recent book, The Polarized Public, you discuss specifically the rise of the Tea Party movement, not as a recent phenomenon, but a continuation of a process that began in the 1970s. Can you give us a little bit of this history of how these conservative people have become more activist and how that's changing the Republican Party?
Well, this increase in the conservatism of the Republican Party has been the most dramatic among the active elements within the party, among those who are the most involved. And, you know, you could trace that back to 1964, even with the takeover of the Republican nominating convention by supporters of Barry Goldwater, but it's continued and accelerated in recent years. And so what you had by 2009, after the election of Barack Obama, was a group of very conservative Republican activists out there who were just waiting and available to be mobilized. That's what happened with the Tea Party movement. These people became activated as a result of their conservatism in combination with their opposition to Barack Obama and his agenda after the Democrats took over the presidency and the Congress.
So one of the things that I found interesting about your discussion of the Tea Party is you have a really nice table in your book that focuses on the demographics of the Tea Party. And one of the things you see there is that very active Republicans also tend to be older, whiter, and more religious than the overall electorate. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what you think this means for the Republican Party as we think toward the future, if the most active people in their party are, older, whiter, and more religious than kind of the general population.
Well, one of the most important changes that we've seen in American politics over the last several decades has been the growing diversity of the American electorate. In terms of race and ethnicity, as well as a growing sort of cultural slash religious divide within the white electorate. And so the electorate's becoming increasingly non-white. The non-white share of voters doubled between 1992 and 2008, from 13% to 26%. And we can, you know, look at the demographic projections and see that that's likely to continue increasing for the foreseeable future. A big part of that, of course, is the growth in Latino voters. Well, that poses a serious challenge to a Republican Party that is very heavily dependent on the support of white conservatives. The challenge is, how do you reach out to this growing segment of the electorate, Latinos and to some extent other non-white voters, without alienating your conservative white base? So far what we've seen is that, for the most part, Republicans have decided to kind of double down on trying to energize and turn out their conservative white base rather than focusing so much on attracting these non-traditional voters. And as time goes on, however, I think that that strategy of kind of focusing on the conservative white base is going to become more and more problematic.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because I know on Monday the Gallup organization produced a poll that shows that President Obama is leading Mitt Romney 66% to 25% among Latino registered voters. And I'm curious if you could just talk for a minute, Professor Abramowitz, about how you think that this Latino issue is going to play out in this election, but also, what would Republicans have to do to get these people to come back into their camp? And can they do that without alienating their base voters?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I think we can certainly expect the Latino vote to continue increasing over time, just as a result of the changing demographics of the country. Now, there's a lag between the growth of the Latino population and the growth of the Latino electorate, due to the fact that, of course, Latinos are less likely to be citizens, and even when they are citizens, they're less likely to be registered to vote and to turn out and vote. But that growth is already evident, and it's having a big impact in some of the swing states this year, particularly Florida and Colorado, Nevada, swing states that have large Latino populations. And we just had some polls come out today that were done by Quinnipiac. In Florida, for example, it showed that Latino vote, which is shifting to become less Cuban American and more diversified, is moving toward Obama, and that is good news for Obama, and is going to pose a real challenge for the Romney campaign. So I think the growth of the Latino electorate is a big challenge to the Republican Party. To appeal to Latino voters, I think Republicans are going to have to do more than just put a few brown faces in prominent positions in the party, sort of the way they've tried to deal with African-American voters without much success. I think they're going to have to actually modify some of their positions on not just immigration, but on domestic economic issues as well. Because another finding from the Gallup poll is that Latino voters, much more than white voters, tend to be in favor of an active role for the federal government and in favor of stronger efforts by the federal government to address economic inequality. So this is going to be a tough challenge for Republicans.
Okay. Quinn Monson, here in Utah, the state's population grew by 23% between 2000 and 2010, and the Latinos accounted for about 78% of that growth. So how is politics here in Utah likely to change going forward with this growth in the Latino population? And also, is there a difference between Utah Latinos and Latinos nationally because of the influence of Mormon political culture here?
That's a lot of questions. I think actually the Latino population has reached double digits in Utah. As you indicated, it's grown tremendously in the past 10 to 20 years, and it's going to grow more. What hasn't changed yet is Latinos aren't making up a substantial part of the voting population. So there, Professor Abramowitz is exactly right. There is this lag, and to the extent that they're eligible to vote, they're not showing up to vote in large numbers yet. But they will eventually, partly because somebody, specifically the Utah Democratic Party, is going to figure out that they've got to mobilize them at some point. From the exit polling data that we have over time, pretty consistently, Hispanics in Utah vote about 60% Democratic, 60 to 65%. And I don't see that changing into the future. So it's a real risk for Republicans to be seen as the anti-immigration reform party and so on. There's some irony here that it's actually to Barack Obama's advantage to not have immigration reform in some ways, because what he does by not having it is he forces that issue onto the agenda for this important constituency, and he galvanizes their sense of affinity with the Democratic Party. The best thing for Republicans to do at this point would be to cut the tail off the dog all in one piece and compromise on this issue and then get it off the table and return to sort of the family values kind of issues that they can appeal to conservative Catholic Latinos with. But that's impossible as long as this specter of their harsh position on immigration hangs over them.
Thank you. That was Quinn Monson. Professor Monson is director of BYU's Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy. We're talking about the future of the Republican Party. Do Republicans need to focus on their conservative base or reach out more to moderate voters? Call us at 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Email us at radiowest@KUER.org or join us on Facebook or Twitter. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Thad Hall, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about the future of the Republican Party, and we invite you to join the conversation. Our number is 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Email us at radiowest@KUER.org or join us on Facebook or Twitter. With us in the studio is Quinn Monson, professor of political science at Brigham Young University and director of the Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy. Joining us from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia is Professor Alan Abramowitz, the author of the books The Disappearing Center and The Polarized Public. Professor Abramowitz, one thing that we see with active Tea Party Republicans is that they are very religious compared to the general electorate. How does this dynamic affect the Republican Party today and the positions that it takes on policy and also in its ability to mobilize voters?
Well, there's no question, I think, that religious conservatives have become a key constituency within the Republican Party. Evangelicals in the South and to some extent other religious voters in other parts of the country have moved toward the Republican Party. The problem this creates for Republicans, though, is that it has pressured Republican candidates and office holders to take some very conservative positions on social issues that are important to these voters, issues such as abortion and gay marriage and gay rights in general. What we've seen over time is that these positions are not necessarily popular with voters who are not part of that religious conservative movement. Particularly on the issue of gay marriage, we've seen a fairly significant shift over time in public opinion with, according to a number of polls, a majority of Americans now actually supporting gay marriage. Again, this is an example of a case where the need to keep the conservative base energized and enthusiastic is coming into conflict with a need to reach out to moderate swing voters in states that are competitive. Not so much of a problem in Utah, which is one of the most Republican states in the nation, but it is a problem in other states where the balance between the parties is closer.
Well, let me turn this over to Quinn then for a second. And I know that in Utah, a lot of people view being Republican and Mormon as being synonymous. And can you explain a little bit about this attitude toward the two parties among the Mormon population?
Sure. These days when you do polling in Utah, especially if somebody self-identifies as an active Mormon, they're very likely to self-identify as Republican, usually somewhere between 80 and 90%. But this has long roots. I used to think that there was a sea change that happened in the late 60s and early 70s with things like Roe v. Wade and other social issues that came onto the scene. But it actually began long before that, in the 40s and 50s. I dug out of the archives Wallace Bennett, Senator Robert Bennett's father, who was the senator from Utah in the 60s, has his papers at BYU. And in the papers in the archives at the library, there was a poll in 1962 conducted for his opponent, David King, who was also an active Mormon, both of them active Mormons. And the question of religion was sort of on the minds of these two candidates, as evidenced by this poll. It's done by Lou Harris, who was JFK's pollster. So he came into Utah and did a poll. And it's interesting because at the time, the Mormon vote split pro-Bennett 57% to 43% for King, the Democrat. So it wasn't a huge difference the way you would see today, where it would be 80-20 or something for the Republican candidate. But what you do see is there's a question in the survey where Harris wrote this question where he said, "We asked voters which political party best stands for the principles of the Mormon Church." And the results came back 46% said for the Republicans, only 6% for the Democrats. And so even back in 1962, this idea that the Republican Party was more consistent with the principles of the Mormon Church was taking hold among Utah voters, something that I think later evidences itself as people vote for Republican candidates and then self-ID as Republicans over time. You see this really large shift so that by the mid-80s and early 90s, you see an overwhelming proportion of Mormons identifying as Republicans. So much so that a couple of years ago, I assigned in one of my intro classes at BYU, I assigned the students to read the party platforms of the two parties and write a blog post on it. And one of the students, after reading the platforms and sort of struggling with her blog post, found herself thinking, hey, as I read this Democratic Party platform, I think I might be a Democrat. And then her question, which was a little bit amusing, was, is that okay? So this idea of being Mormon and being Republican has taken hold to such an extent that for some kids, it's just foreign, the idea that they might have attitudes that are consistent with the Democratic Party, even though the church clearly has a political neutrality policy and says that things with both parties are consistent with church doctrine and so on. So it's just become very, very one-sided.
Well, that's a great story of how the world works in Utah sometimes. Professor Abramowitz, you brought up this issue of gay marriage, and obviously this is one of the touchstone issues in politics today. And recent polling, they always refer to the fact that 54% of adults nationally support same-sex couples being able to marry. But if you look at the data for Republicans, it's quite low, actually, just among that party, which is about 27% of Republicans support it. But you do see quite a bit of support among independents and young people. And so I'm curious to know, given this trend toward support of same-sex marriage among young people and independents, is this opposition to same-sex marriage a problem for the Republican Party?
Well, I think it is a problem for the Republican Party in some parts of the country. As I said, if you look at the swing states and certainly in the more Democratic states, support for gay marriage has now reached the point where that is no longer an issue that can be used as a wedge issue against Democrats the way Republicans were using it, back in 2004. So I think the perception that the Republican Party is hostile to the interests of gays, along with the perception that it's hostile to the interests of Latinos, certainly is a problem for the Republican Party in a good many parts of the country.
So let me just follow up on that real quick. Are gay marriage and this issue of the position of Republicans toward Latinos, is this just becoming a symbol of the party not being open, tolerant, and open-minded?
Well, I think that's true in part. So I think that the perception that the Republican Party is hostile to the interests of gays and Latinos is hurting the party, not just among gays and Latinos, but to some extent it's hurting the party among more moderate white voters who perceive the party as becoming more extreme. Now, of course, this depends, again, on what part of the country you're talking about. So in the South, in much of the Mountain West, including Utah, this opposition to gay marriage is not a problem for the Republican Party. In fact, that's a position I think that is quite popular with voters, or at least a majority of voters in those parts of the country. But again, in these swing states, and presidential elections nowadays tend to be very closely contested, and they tend to come down to about 8 or 10 or 12 swing states. And in those swing states, I think that the perception that the Republican Party is becoming more and more extreme is a problem.
We're talking about the future of the Republican Party, and we invite you to join the conversation. Our number is 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. And you can also email us at radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a call. We're going to take a call from Terry in Salt Lake City. Terry, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My comment is I'm always astounded how the electorate votes for certain politicians, and I guess Romney and Hatch would be the example right now, who shift their position seemingly to just get elected. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you. Would you like to take a first stab at that, Quinn?
Well, I don't think politicians shifting their positions is anything new, something we've seen since we've had politicians to take positions on. I think what becomes a problem for politicians is if they shift and then shift back again. If they shift multiple times or if the shift appears to be calculated, this is what's caused problems for Romney, is that he appears to go back and forth, or it appears to not be genuine to some people. I think it's been much less of a problem for Orrin Hatch, as he's sort of redefined himself as a true conservative, back to his sort of 1970s conservative roots. I don't think he's had as much problem doing that as Romney has trying to become a conservative Republican.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it really depends very much on how you do it, on the timing. And after all, President Obama has switched his position on a number of things. He switched his position on dealing with terrorism. He's become, I think, much more aggressive in the way that he deals with that issue than he appeared to be during the 2008 campaign. And, of course, he's now switched his position on the issue of gay marriage. So, I think almost all politicians, at least those who rise to prominence in national politics, change their positions over time. Romney's problem, as Quinn was saying, I think, is that he's changed his positions on quite a few things and fairly recently and fairly dramatically. And I think that makes it more of a problem than if it's more gradual or more subtle.
It's also a problem for Romney because it's all on YouTube now.
True.
In the modern age, you can go to the tape and
right.
There's lots of mashups on YouTube of Romney saying one thing and then another. I think you could do that for a lot of politicians, and they just don't have it done to them because they're not running for president.
And in the past, politicians could really kind of pitch their message to the particular audience that they were speaking to a much greater extent than they can now, because now if your message is different from one audience to another, you're almost certainly going to get caught doing that. And it's going, as you said, it's going to be out there on YouTube. It's going to be on the Internet, and it's going to be on the news.
Terry, thank you for your call. The number here is 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. And the email address is radiowest@kuer.org. I'd like to take a call from John in Salt Lake City. John, thank you for calling into the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me. My comment is that as a young voter, I'm 26, sort of in this group that I think people are looking at as you know, important in the future of the GOP, either being successful or not. I think that the GOP could pull a lot more young voters in simply by embracing a little more nuance and a little more gray area in their platform. And I think this is because we're not necessarily inherently liberal for life as young people, but I do think that millennials have been so exposed to a vast amount of information since a young age that we're used to complex ideas. We're used to, for example, rational people changing their minds. We're used to discovering that we're wrong about something. I'm not saying this across the board 100%, but I think on average, we're more comfortable than maybe a previous generation was with, since this is what you've been talking about, with like a politician changing their mind. That seems like something a thinking person would do. And we're, I think right now, though, that the Democrats are doing a better job of that. So they're doing a better job of illustrating the complexities of society and addressing them with, or attempting to address them with their platform. And that's what I think the GOP could do to pull in liberally minded youth who are not necessarily always going to want to vote, you know, fiscally and socially liberal, but probably socially liberal, but maybe not fiscally liberal.
John, thank you so much for your call. Professor Abramowitz, you want to take a stab at that?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that the Republican Party could do a better job of reaching out to young voters by moderating some of its positions, particularly on social issues. But that's true what the Republican Party needs to do, I think, to reach out to minority voters as well, and to Latino voters in particular. It's more easily said than done, because to do that would, again, be to risk alienating the conservative base of the party. So that would be risky, especially in a primary election for a Republican candidate. The other thing to keep in mind with younger voters is that one of the main reasons why younger voters are considerably more Democratic than older voters are today is that the racial composition, the racial and ethnic composition of those age groups are very different, that as the electorate's changing and the non-white share of the electorate is growing, of course, we see the most dramatic difference in the youngest age groups. So among voters today under the age of 30, the percentage of African-Americans, Latinos, and other non-whites is much greater than in the past, and it's much greater than it is today among older voters. And that is an important factor.
So let me follow up with that real quick. And we have about if you could just kind of give a short answer to this. You know, one of the things that we were seeing, you were talking about the moderation, is this whole issue of being primaried among Republicans, where
right.
Republican, basically what that means is Republicans have a conservative candidate, you know, who runs to their right and says you're not conservative enough.
Right.
And we've obviously seen that here in Utah. Can you
right.
just talk for just like for just 1 minute about that threat and what it means for Republican positions and their ability to moderate?
Oh, I think it's very significant. I think that the threat of being primaried is one of the main reasons why we're seeing this rightward shift, particularly since the rise of the Tea Party movement. And, you know, although Orrin Hatch survived yesterday pretty easily, another Republican incumbent there in one of the House districts was defeated in a primary by a Tea Party challenger. Now, I guess it wasn't just about ideology there, but that probably was one factor. And we've seen that around the country. We saw it in Indiana, for example, with the defeat of Senator Lugar by a Tea Party challenger. So I think that that fear of being primaried, particularly in a place like Utah that's solidly Republican, you know, where the primary really is the most significant election, is a big concern of candidates and elected officials.
That's Professor Alan Abramowitz. He's a professor of political science at Emory University and the author of the book, The Polarized Public. We're talking about the future of the Republican Party. Call us at 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Or join us on Facebook or Twitter. We're going to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Thad Hall, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. We're talking today about the future of the Republican Party, and we hope you'll join us. With us are Quinn Monson, professor of political science at Brigham Young University, and Alan Abramowitz, a professor of political science at Emory University. Joining us now is former Congressman Mickey Edwards. Congressman Edwards represented Oklahoma from 1977 to 1993, and he has taught at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and at George Washington University. He is currently a vice president at the Aspen Institute, and he's the author of the book, Parties Versus the People, How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into Americans. Our number is 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. And you can also join us on Facebook or Twitter. Welcome to the program, Congressman Edwards.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on. I wanted to ask you a quick question just to start off, and I have a follow-up to go with it, which will make sense. So when you were in Congress, how did you view yourself as being a conservative Republican?
When I was in Congress, I was the national chairman of the American Conservative Union, and I was one of the three founders of the Heritage Foundation. I think I was in that category.
Well, I asked that because I looked up your voting record on the website VoteView.com, which has a historical record of ideology for all members of Congress. And you had the same voting record as somebody who most of our listeners will know, Congressman Newt Gingrich, who became Speaker of the House. And then I looked at where you would fall today, and you would be the fifth most liberal member of the Republican caucus. So what does that tell you?
Well, let me just tell you, if Ronald Reagan were a member of Congress today or Barry Goldwater, they'd be right there with me.
So what do you make of the movement of the Republican Party in Congress from you being a more liberal, more conservative member of the House to now you'd be one of the most liberal?
Well, I think one of the things that's happened is that I heard some of the earlier comments, and you know, part of it is the way the party system, and especially the primary system, has forced candidates to move to the right in order to even survive politically, because it's not a matter in Utah or in other states of appealing to the general electorate. It's a matter of appealing to those small numbers who are going to be at the party convention or at a party primary, who are going to decide who can be on the ballot. And those tend to be, and this is, by the way, I will also say, on the Democratic side, they tend to be the more liberal and the more ideological. And on the Republican side, the more conservative and ideological. And when you're the more ideological, you're less inclined to compromise. One of the things that I believe in is that in politics, just like in business or anything else, incentives matter. And we've created a system in which the incentives are to be very ideological and to not compromise, because compromise is considered a sellout. And that's paralyzed. It not only has affected where Republicans stand farther to the right than they were, Democrats farther to the left than they were, but it's also had the effect of making it impossible to get agreement in Congress on a lot of things that are not really ideological, you know, things that you need to do to help govern the country.
So in your upcoming book, Parties Versus the People, you have a couple of ideas about how to address those problems. Could you just pick one or two that you think would be the most crucial for trying to...
Part of my book talks about what changes need to be made inside the Congress itself, having a nonpartisan speaker, nonpartisan committee staff, not letting party leaders choose who sits on what committees and that sort of thing, which I think is very important. But on the electoral side, California and Washington State have sort of blazed a path for us. 24 states allow I don't know which ones, you know, that you cover, but 24 states have in their state constitutions provisions for the voters to go out with an initiative petition and change the laws. Washington and California have gotten rid of closed party primaries. They've taken away this system that forces you to appeal to the most extreme elements. They've also, and that's one of the things I strongly recommend in my book for other states to do, I recommend getting rid of what's called a sore loser law, because in every state but four, the parties have arranged to get sore loser laws enacted that say if you ran in your party's primary and you lost, you can't be on the ballot. Basically, you're telling the voters of the state, you know, that they don't have that option. You need to get rid of those laws. And then finally, both of the California and Washington state enacted changes in the way congressional districts are drawn so that they have now nonpartisan redistricting commissions rather than letting the whichever party controls the legislature draw party lines for the partisan advantage. So those are some of the kinds of things that really have to be changed. I guess the basic point I'm trying to make in my book is it's not a matter of who we elect. We keep saying, well, we'll elect this person, it will be better, and it isn't. So we elect that person, then it'll be better, and it isn't. And it's because of the system. We really need to make systemic changes if we're going to get anything improved.
So looking at the Congress today from your position as a veteran of this process, but also being outside of it now, you know, one of the key issues that's come up for Republicans is the budget that's put forth by Congressman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin. And I'm curious to know, as you look at that, what do you think would happen if parts of Congressman Ryan's budget actually get enacted? What would happen to the Republican Party? So if you think about issues like making reforms to Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and these kind of tax cuts, what do you worry about what would happen to the Republican Party if these kind of changes were made?
No, because I think if the system were the way I would like it to be, you would have Paul Ryan's budget as the piece of legislation that is on the table to begin the discussions and where you would make, you know, the compromises. I don't think we're ready to have the Paul Ryan's budget enacted as is without any amendment. I don't think a lot of the Republicans are ready to do that, but they see it as a direction. That's what the budget is. It's a direction. It's a guide for where you go. So what Republicans have to remember is that the Constitution not only put limits on government, it also empowered government. So there's some things you have to do and some things you're entitled to do if the public wants it, you know, it's self-government and it is properly constitutional to do that. So you have to sit down and say, here's a plan. Medical costs are too high. We don't want the government telling us what to do. Let's sit down around a table and figure out how can we address the problem, so that more people have access to health care, but the government is not in here, you know, taking up all the burden. So whether it's that or transportation or infrastructure or, you know, anything else, you sit down and work it out. Because if we go all the way on immigration or on the budget or any of these other things, as far as some of our people have staked it out, you know, the Republican Party will never win another election. The American people agree with a lot of what Republicans are saying, but not all of it. And if you just say, well, okay, we think there's a problem with too many illegal immigrants, we have to do something about it, and then you conduct it as though it's a war against the children of people who came in, you know, you turn off a lot of people. And political parties aren't supposed to be turning off voters. They're supposed to be, you know, trying to serve what those people whose government it is, you know, would like to see achieved.
Sure. And Quinn, I think you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that these systemic kinds of things cut both ways. So in the Utah case, for example, we have this convention system that I think leads to pretty conservative nominees.
Right.
But when the Democrats slip one through because the Republicans sort of self-destruct or in a primary situation, and you get somebody like Jim Matheson, who really is a pretty conservative Democrat, it becomes impossible for the Republicans, or nearly impossible for them, to win it back, because
Absolutely.
They have this dysfunctional system that produces a very conservative nominee time after time, and they're unable to win those moderate Republican voters back.
You're absolutely right. In fact, to use another example, and the Utah example is a very good one, what happened in Delaware, where the Republicans could have won the seat that Joe Biden had in the Senate with Mike Castle, and because Christine O'Donnell, you know, won just 30,000 votes, but in a closed party primary, Castle couldn't run in November, and now that's a Democrat seat. Chris Coons has it, and the chances of Republicans winning it back are very slim. And so that's another example. So actually, a lot of the people who say that they're doing this because they want to move the country in a more conservative direction are having the opposite effect. They're putting forth candidates that the public can't swallow, and as a result of it, it's electing Democrats. Chris Coons, who's a friend of mine, is a very liberal Democrat. And so the Tea Party people actually ended up hurting the cause they say they believe in.
So let me turn just really quickly to Professor Abramowitz. What do the polling data show on these types of reforms that are in Paul Ryan's budget?
Well, you know, it depends on how you ask the people about this. It's a very asking about the budget is very difficult. It's boiling it down to polling questions.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know is that voters support the concept of balancing the budget and reducing the deficit and cutting government spending when those ideas are presented sort of in the abstract. However, when you then ask them about cutting specific government programs, you get a very different picture, and you find that in general, with just a few exceptions, most Americans don't want to see those specific government programs cut. It's sort of a debate about how the issue is framed. And I think some of the specific cuts that are in the Ryan budget would actually be quite unpopular if they were presented to the public. But I wanted to briefly say something about these ideas about procedural reforms. Frankly, I'm not optimistic about those actually producing the outcome that's desired here. In terms of the internal reforms of Congress, I just think it's unrealistic. You're just not going to get the party leadership to give up those powers. You're not going to get a shared speakership or a seat control over committee assignments and things like that. It's never been done that way, and it's not going to be done that way now. In terms of the reforms of the electoral process, I don't think it's going to work because the divisions between the parties actually reflect very deep underlying divisions in the country. I just don't think California is going to become any less polarized despite the change in the primary system. I'll make that prediction right now. The parties are going to be just as polarized as they were before because the parties in California represent very different constituencies. Democratic Party is predominantly, has a huge percentage of Latinos and non-whites and liberal whites. Republican Party is a conservative white party in California. That's not going to change.
So, Congressman Edwards, let me ask you just one final question, which is,
sure.
When you think about your party 10 years from now, given the realities of what you actually see on the ground, what do you think it's going to look like?
Well, yeah. First, let me say, hi, Ellen.
We've had this discussion before.
and Ellen, I even quote you in my book. Yeah, so glad to hear from you.
Well, I appreciate that.
I think the Republican Party is in a very precarious position right now, and that's because driven by the people who win primaries, or people like Dick Lugar having to try to move farther to the right in order to win a primary, which he did not do. What's happening is the Republican Party is going to be more and more taking positions that the bulk of the voters don't like. And, take, for example, on the health care bill, where a very large majority of voters do not like the individual mandate, But there's a lot of other things in that bill that they like a lot. And to simply say, we're just going to repeal the whole thing, you know, it doesn't apply. And so there's no nuance anymore. There's no let's look at how what's the best thing for the country. That's why the subtitle of my book, you know, the book, it's The Parties Versus the People, which is exactly the way I see it. But the subtitle, which was taken from the article I had in The Atlantic on this, was How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into Americans. And I'm not trying to end party affiliation, but what I'm trying to do is create a situation where the people who we have elected sit down around the table together, say, okay, we got elected, we're all Americans together, let's look at the problems and see if we can address them. And the Republican Party is starting to lock itself into a corner where it's not going to be able to do that, and the American people are going to say, you know, this isn't working. These people aren't really interested in helping to govern the country. They, you know, it's just a power-seeking club.
Right.
And unless there are some changes in that, I think the Republican Party is in danger of just simply becoming a non-factor.
Thank you so much for being on the program. That was Congressman Mickey Edwards, who is now Vice President of the Aspen Institute. We also had in the studio Quinn Monson, director of BYU's Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy. And coming to us from Atlanta, Georgia, was Alan Abramowitz, who is professor of political science at Emory University and the author of the book The Polarized Public and the book The Disappearing Center. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. Our executive producer is Doug Fabrizio. I'm Thad Hall, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Utah. Thank you very much.